Welcome, everyone. Episode 381 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek. It is December, and that means somehow the NBA season is only 3 weeks away as of today. So we have to cram in a lot of season previews in a very short period of time. We will start today with the Western Conference lottery teams from last season. Before we get into those, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And we are also recording today on Locker Room. So if you are an iOS device, download the Locker Room app. You can come listen to us live, ask us questions, even come up on stage with us and speak in a live podcast. It's a ton of fun. So if you have questions about your favorite team, we're going to be doing a lot of season previews over the next few weeks. So come hang out on the Locker Room app on iOS. Joining me today, as always, is a man who I know is very excited to talk about the Minnesota Timberwolves in 10 minutes. Morten Jensen, how's it going?
It's going okay. The Timberwolves. Could we just skip them? Because I'm really not in the mood.
On the bright side, we like every year we usually do these division by division, and we just like don't have time based on how the calendar is, and we always dread the Southeast division. This time we don't have a Southeast division pod, so that's a win.
That's true. That is true. Oh my God, we're actually going to enter the NBA season on a high note. That's fantastic.
Well, I guess you could say the Eastern Conference Lottery Teams pod is effectively the Southeast Division pod, but we'll save that for...
Andrew, you ruined it.
We'll save it for a later date. So, Mort, I feel like we're not saying these teams are going to be lottery teams this year. We're just going 15-1 up the standings from last year. So... Right. Starting at number 15, remarkably, we have to begin with the Golden State Warriors, who had a league-worst 15-50 record. Obviously, injuries, Klay Thompson, Steph Curry breaks his hand, Draymond Green just kind of half-asses it through the year. That could explain a lot of this away. You know, Steph is now back, which is great. They get James Wiseman at number 2. Great. The bad news is Klay Thompson tears his Achilles. He's out for the year. They take Kelly Oubre into their big trade exception. So, you know, they've done well enough to rebound from Klay's injury, but more like how does Klay's injury factor into their season outlook? Did you have them as possible contenders before, and now this drops them down to a playoff team? Are they even a playoff team without Klay? Like, where do you see these Klayless Warriors fitting into the postseason picture?
I never had them as a surefire contender because we just had so many moving parts that we didn't know the answer to, right? Like, Steph missed so much time. Klay missed the entire year. You know, Wiggins hadn't played there for more than, 14 games, 12 games, something like that. So there were so many moving parts that it would be just so premature to go, oh, they're a contender. What they would have been, in my eye, is definitely a contender to be part of the contender conversation. That's a little tongue twisting, but you catch my drift. Mm-hmm. I do think they're a playoff team. I think Klay's injury is so huge, unfortunately, because he's just one of those guys who's superbly efficient, and not just the three, right? It's the fact that when you're a guy who doesn't take up many possessions in terms of on ball time, but you produce at a high level, that's also efficiency. Like, this is a dude who doesn't dribble a whole lot. He catches, he shoots, and just off of that action, you know, he'll get you 18, 20 points a night. That's a tremendous luxury and quite honestly a necessity as well. Not having that guy right there and having to funnel the offense significantly more through Steph and Oubre and Wiggins, it's going to probably be an offense that is less efficient and maybe a little bit slower as well.
Yeah. I mean, you're certainly sacrificing efficiency, if nothing else, because Klay is just one of the most lethal three-point shooters we've ever seen. And,
right,
you know, I don't think anyone would say that about Andrew Wiggins, especially. But do you think, you know, Wiggins is probably now moving into a higher usage role than the Warriors envisioned when they acquired him? They figured, okay, Steph and Clay are going to be our two main guys. Wiggins can be, you know, more of this complimentary 3 and D guy. You know, what are your expectations for Wiggins and Oubre now as well? How do you see these two guys picking up the slack for what, you know, Clay's injury creates?
So I actually think part of why they got Oubre was basically to limit the usage rate of Andrew Wiggins as well. Mm-hmm. I think they knew that they needed to do something here, and Wiggins is not going to be that second guy necessarily. Oubre is a very capable offensive player, even though he does have his weaknesses. So I think those two are probably going to tie for like the second. They're going to juggle for second leading scorer on the team.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to figure out like what's more efficient. Like, are we going to use Wiggins in the 3 and D role? Are we going to use Oubre that kind of way? You know, what is the playing style going to be? How are we going to find success for them? Because Wiggins is, like you said, is not necessarily a good 3-point shooter. He has shown flashes, but overall he's not. Defensively, he's also not that great. So the whole 3 and D argument kind of goes out the window. Oubre, on the other hand, I think is one of those new age fours who can really get things going, like moving. They will have multiple ball handlers. I think Draymond could have a pretty good season, actually, because he'll have more targets to play with, even though he doesn't have Clay. But in terms of the fit with Oubre and Wiggins, I don't know, because it's such a convoluted court all of a sudden. Like, there isn't that release valve in Clay anymore. So now those two guys, in Oubre and Wiggins, they have to share possessions, and they have to, you know, create for themselves, and they have to get into the paint by themselves, and it could go really badly as well. I'm actually pretty optimistic that it'll work out. I think they're definitely a playoff team, but there is a world wherein this goes all the way bad.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I'm curious to see how Steve Kerr, like, what is their starting lineup without Clay? Is Andrew Wiggins the starting three? And then...
No, two.
Yeah, right? And then Oubre's the three, Draymond's the four, and James Wiseman's the five.
Yeah,
I mean, I think that's the most likely, but at the same time, you know, are both Wiggins and Oubre then playing out of position?
Yes.
Yeah.
But again, position, right?
Right.
I mean, it's in today's NBA, is that really a problem?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think shooting is going to be an issue for this team. Like, you're not, you know, Draymond is... These guys can hit, like, Wiggins can hit a three. Draymond can hit a three. But they're just such, you know, you're going to happily defer. Like, you're going to leave those guys open more often than not, because you're going to be like, all right, I dare you to hit this shot. We'll close off other things. You know, we'll double team Steph to make sure he's not getting this shot. If it means an open three for Draymond, so be it. That's fine. You live with that type of shot. You know, Wiseman, I think it's just a huge mystery box at this point. They're very high on the kid. You know, Steph gave an interview, I think it was to the Undefeated yesterday, with Mark J. Spears, where, you know, he's saying, like, the sky's the limit for this kid, and me and Dre are going to be really hard on him to, like, show him what it means to be great. But, you know, this is a theme that we'll hit throughout these next few season previews, just given, you know, he didn't know where he was playing 2 weeks ago. Like, the draft was 2 weeks ago. You know, they don't have a summer league. They don't have an off season. I don't think it's fair to expect any of these kids to hit the ground running, and especially for a guy like Wiseman, who's played 3 games of competitive basketball. Actually, no, 0 games of competitive basketball in the last calendar year, right? His first 3 games were in, like, October and November. So I think there are a lot of question marks with this Warriors team, and that isn't to say they're not going to be a playoff team, because I'm with you. I think they likely will be, but I think Clay's injury knocked down any chance they had of being a legit contender this year.
I would agree. I think this could be a huge year for Eric Pascal. Mm-hmm. I think he will be one of those guys who could be, if he comes in off the bench and plays like the 4-3, just a combo forward role, and provides some stability, He's not a knockdown shooter, but much like with Wiggins and Oubre, he can hit a three in that sense. And he's just big and burly. He can get to the line. He can convert at the line as well. If he becomes one of those reliable options, you know, you can sort of mix and match who you have on the court at the same time. And that would be huge for them.
Yeah, I think seeing how the rest of their, like, we laid out their presumptive starting five, seeing how the rest of their supporting cast shakes out is another big storyline with this team, because, you know, Alec Burks and Glenn Robinson played very sizable roles for this injury-ravaged Warriors team. Both of them are gone. They did bring back Kent Bazemore, which is nice, and they got Brad Wanamaker, so they, like, they have rotation-level talent on the bench. It's just...
Marquise Chris.
Yeah. I'm curious to see how it all shakes out. I think it's safe to say, you know, Steve Kerr is probably yearning for the days where he had too much talent on his hands, and that was his problem.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, the Clay news is really the big story of this year. Yeah. I mean, you can look directly at it. If they somehow miss the playoffs, again, I don't think they will, but you could point to that in isolation and go, well, that's that.
Yeah, 100%. Let's go to the Timberwolves now, Mort, who had, you know, Warriors were number two pick. Timberwolves had the number one pick. They ended up going with Anthony Edwards, who of the top three prospects seemed to be the best fit with D'Angelo Russell and Karl Anthony Towns. But then they also traded for Ricky Rubio. They brought him back to Minnesota, and they re-signed Malik Beasley to a four-year, $60 million deal. So suddenly that backcourt's looking pretty crowded. How do you see the minutes and rotation shaking out there?
So, I actually think they're going to move D'Angelo to the two. Mm-hmm. I have to assume that's the play. You don't bring in Ricky Rubio to have him be your backup point guard, I don't think. You need some stability. You need some defense. And I realize that Russell loves having the ball in his hands. That's fine. You can kind of stagger the two. They can start together, play, I don't know, 12, 15 minutes together a night, and otherwise you can stagger them. So, in effect, Russell also becomes the backup point guard, if you catch my drift.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm not really concerned about that. What I am concerned about is finding minutes for Josh Okogie and Jared Culver at the same time, because those two are not necessarily great offensive players. In fact, they are definitely not great offensive players.
Yeah,
they are strong defensive-minded guys, and that has value. Then there's Malik Beasley, who I think is going to come in as some sort of super sub, like can play the 2-3, just the wing position, and just give you buckets. But again, that means you have to figure out, what do we do with Okogie and Culver? And I have a take that is probably really, really bad, but I want to see it anyway.
I'm excited.
And I realize it's bad because Jared Culver is not a guy who, I think he has like a 6'9 wingspan or something, so he would definitely be undersized at the four.
Oh, yes.
But
oh, yes.
I would like to see it, though.
I mean, I honestly think that's what they're going to have to do more often than not, just because they don't have a ton of forward depth. Ed Davis, I guess, and like Jake Layman, cool, but... You know, there's...
Like, no.
Yeah. So I feel like they are going to... You know, maybe they saw what OKC did last year with these Chris Paul, SGA, Schroeder lineups. That three-guard lineup was, like, lethally effective for the Thunder. So maybe they say, you know, that's the route we're going, in part out of necessity. And then, like, maybe, you know, we've been saying ever since they acquired Russell that defense was not going to be their calling card. So,
right.
They, you know, a three or four guard lineup just completely lean into offense and just run and gun teams out of the gym because you sure as hell aren't stopping them either way.
Yeah. I'm actually intrigued because, or not intrigued, I'm smiling a little bit because the whole lineup I presented to you, at no point did you stop me and ask a very obvious question. What about Anthony Edwards?
Yeah, I mean, well, does that come back to, you know, do we expect him to hit the ground running, or is it going to take him time to get acclimated, especially compared to...
I mean, does it matter? He's the number one pick. He almost has to play at least 20 minutes from the start, right?
You would think so. I mean, I don't know what to expect from any rookie this year. Like, I don't know if you can I mean, maybe he's playing 20 minutes, but, like, I don't think any rookie is playing 35 minutes out the gate, or if they do, I don't think they're going to be very good. So, the Timberwolves, they have the guard depth to actually be okay with that. Like, you can, even if Edwards is not an immediate factor, between Russell, Rubio, Beasley, Culver, Okogie, like, they've got, you know, five guys who realistically could just split minutes at the 1-2-3, and then you just plug in gaps at the four next to Towns.
Let me put it this way. It's not going to be pretty.
No. Do you think this is the worst? It's going to be pretty. Do you think they're the worst team in the West next year?
That's harsh. That harsh. I don't know if they're going to be the worst. I think they have talent. It's just misplaced. It's sort of like the Pelicans when they had Davis and Boogie and Julius Randle. Like, it was just not spread out all that much. Like, they had a ton of talent. It didn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
In terms, I have a hard time seeing them not getting better than the Kings, right?
I think those two teams are in contention. When I say worst team in the West, it's just like you have to look at the rest of the West. That's not necessarily an insult to the Timberwolves. It's just like some team has to finish 15th. I don't know who it's going to be, but, you know.
It could be the Spurs. Oh, my God. It actually could.
Yeah. I think Kings, Spurs, and T-Wolves. Because, like, the Warriors, we just said, are probably going to be a playoff team. Then the other ones are the Pelicans, Suns, Grizzlies are the three other teams that didn't make the playoffs last year. You know, I don't think any of those teams are in contention for 15th in the West unless, like, they just get absolutely ransacked by injuries.
Yeah.
So, you know, given how bad I think Minnesota's defense is going to be, I could at least see it. I'm not saying it's definitely going to happen, but, really, look at their forward depth chart. It's horrific. Yeah. What are they going to do there? They just got Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, I think. So, and, like, he might have to play a sizable role for this team.
Ugh. I would rather just play Jared Vanderbilt and just be done with it because he's actually good. What's the protection on the 21 pick in Minnesota?
It's top three, I believe.
Oh, man. And considering this draft class, and I've been looking early on, because I knew coming in this would be a good draft class, but oh boy, this is going to be really good actually. So even if they end up having to sacrifice like a top four pick, like the number fourth pick, that's going to be a huge, huge like loss for them.
Yeah.
But if they get a top three pick again, then we're in business because there are a lot of wings, a lot of lead guards. A lot of players who can turn a franchise around in this draft. So, you know, it might even behoove them to finish 15th.
Right. I mean, that's another point is if they get off to a slow start, you know, knowing they owe a top three protected pick to the Warriors, do they? Oh, Karl Anthony Towns suddenly has an ankle sprain and he's out for 2 months.
Yeah. Or like suddenly, oh, we got a great offer for Josh Okogie. Like, who can say no to a top 55 protected?
right. Yeah, expect some chicanery from the Timberwolves if their season gets off the rails.
Right.
So let's go to the Pelicans now, Mort. This caught my eye because, you know, there's this NBA media week going on. And David Griffin, the Pelicans executive vice president of basketball operations, spoke with reporters yesterday about Zion. He said basically they envision him playing the three, defending the three, and he's going to be on the handle. What do you think of that?
Mm-hmm. So, this is a positionless NBA. I don't necessarily mind it. I do think they have an advantage if they put him at the traditional four, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
because he can handle the ball the way that he can. Like, then you have Ingram sliding into the three spot. You obviously have, well, Lonzo probably, and then in a couple of years, maybe next year, Kyler Lewis, but you have playmaking at the one and two, then you would have playmaking at the three via Ingram, playmaking at the four with Zion. So I think like moving down the positions and giving them less flexibility, I'm not in love with that. But I have to assume it's because they, you know, got Steven Adams and they want to start him at center, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which I also think is just why. Like, just invest in your youth instead. I don't disagree that Steven Adams is good. He clearly is. But he doesn't really fit their age curve right now. You have Jackson Hayes waiting in the wing. This does seem, in a less perverse way, like it's Yandre Jordan, Jared Allen situation.
Mm. Well, yeah, I was about to ask what you thought of the Steven Adams trade and extension next, so I'm glad you jumped in there with that. But so I will say Griffin spoke about Adams and he said a big reason is because Adams is such an elite screen setter. He can do that on and off the ball. Zion can be used as a cutter away from the ball. He can be used as a ball handler. He also said, I think people put an awful lot of stock into the ability to stretch the court and shoot from the big position. But not enough is made of the ability to set a physical screen and to make the right read as a passer, and Steven gives us that.
I don't disagree with that, by the way. I mean, he's right. There are more ways to create an efficient offense than just, hey, shoot the three. Mm-hmm. Totally agree with that. I just wonder if you end up sacrificing ball handling. So where's Ingram going to play? You know, the guy you just gave a 5-year max to.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I would guess their starting lineup will be, you know, 3-4-5. We'll get to the backcourt in a minute. Ingram, Zion, Adams. And then, you know, when Ingram rests, maybe you can slide Zion down then. And, like, right. Jackson Hayes will have minutes. But, yeah, I mean, if anything, I would have thought Zion would move more up a position than down. So I'm not saying this isn't going to work. I'm just, like, genuinely intrigued to see what will happen. I mean, I like, you know, especially for a team in New Orleans' position where they'll face some pressure to make the playoffs this year, but it's not like we need to make the playoffs right now or Zion's going to demand a trade. Like, they're still very early into their rebuild, their post-Anthony Davis rebuild. So, you know, this is the time to be experimenting with your young guys and see, like, push them beyond their limits and see, you know, exactly what they can and cannot do, and then that helps you fill out the rest of your roster. So right. I'm intrigued to see Zion at the three. I don't think this is like a Kevin Durant at the two, like PJ Carlesimo back in the Supersonics days.
I will say this, though. They have sort of the same problem with too many wings, right? Because they're also looking for minutes for Josh Hart and Nickeil Alexander-Walker. Mm-hmm. JJ Redick is still there. You know, they have to. They also got Eric Bledsoe, and Lonzo Ball is still there. You know, there are a lot of mouths to feed. And, I mean, at some point, I wouldn't be surprised at a consolidation move.
Yeah, so that was my question about their backcourt, is how do you see that shaking out with Drew Holiday now gone? Right. Do you think Bledsoe and Lonzo can play together as the starting one and two, or do you think it's, you know, one of Bledsoe or Lonzo, and then either Redick or Hart as like a more traditional two guard?
Defensively, I think they can play together. Offensively, I think it could be ugly, especially if you do the whole, you know, play Zion extended minutes at the three. Because while I agree with David Griffin that spacing isn't everything, you still need it. Mm-hmm. And if you trot out a lineup with Bledsoe, Ball, Zion, Steven Adams, and insert fifth guy here.
Yeah.
That's I would argue then you are making a mockery of the entire concept of spacing. To answer your question, I think JJ Redick gets that nod. I have to assume so. He's still an elite shooter that doesn't go away. Lonzo and JJ, I think, is the long-term play. I mean, they have to figure out at some point what they have in Lonzo. Unless they already know, you know, we know what we have. We know that he's going to hit restricted free agency. We know what we're willing to match, and we know what we're willing to let him walk for. I mean, outside of that, I'm not sure.
Yeah, because he is eligible for an extension right now. If he doesn't sign one by December 21st, he will be a restricted free agent next offseason. So they do face the pressure of having to figure out what do we have in him? Is he our long-term starting point guard? But then you get a guy like Eric Bledsoe, who, you know, just started for a Milwaukee Bucks team that was supposed to win the finals. I can't imagine he would be thrilled going to a, you know, playoff hopeful, but coming off the bench for them behind, you know, a fourth-year point guard.
Right.
So there's a lot, a lot to figure out in New Orleans. Let's go to the Sacramento Kings, Mort, who... who, I'll give them credit, because I was writing a piece for FanSided earlier today about, you know, teams that got worse in free agency, and I was going to obviously pick the Kings as one of them, because they lost Bogdan Bogdanovic. They were talking about their decision not to match was to maintain salary flexibility moving forward. Because their books are, their books are shockingly clean after this upcoming season. Even though De'Aaron Fox's extension is going to kick in, but like they only technically have three guys under contract until they pick up Bagley's fourth year option. But you know that goes to show they actually don't have a ton of depth on this team. So how do they replace the loss of Bogdanovic, who, you know, played a critical role for them first as, you know, their primary six man, and they moved into the starting lineup, took over for Buddy Hield?
Prayer? I don't know. I mean, look, this is the Kings. I don't know. This is a question for Vivek Ranadive. What kind of crazy-ass scheme has he set himself up for? Are they just going to play 3-on-5 now? I don't know. Maybe he has the solution. Maybe he has a very creative solution. I virtually hate everything that the Kings have done over the past few years, considering, you know, where they end up. Remember a couple years ago where we actually started becoming somewhat high on their long-term prospects?
Yeah.
You know, they have just found a... Right, exactly. Like, the one good thing they did was extend De'Aaron Fox, which, great, okay, but they can't get out of their own way. Apparently they said that Buddy Hield is back in the swing of things and like dedicated. Sure, I think that's company speak. I don't think a guy who refused to take up a phone call from his coach is okay and then locked in and ready to go. I think that is, I don't believe that. Then, okay, Tyrese Halliburton, sure, they have him coming in. They have Harrison Barnes still, but like, to what end? Like, what is the ceiling for this team? What are they looking for? What are they trying to accomplish here? I don't even know. Are they trying to crap out to actually get a high draft pick? They probably should, considering where they are. But I'm guessing they're not, because they keep talking about being competitive and then saying, oh, we want cap flexibility, so let's not match Bogdan Bogdanovic, because obviously we're so, you know, fantastic a free agent destination. We have so much interest from players every single year, right? Oh, I'm tired. They it seems like they just cannot get out of their own way, and I feel so bad for Monty McNair, because I'm not putting anything at his feet.
Yeah, I mean, the problem for them is that Bogdanovic was their one true wing. I mean, you look at their depth chart, like, I feel pretty good about their backcourt. De'Aaron Fox, a Buddy Hield starting, Corey Joseph, Tyrese Halliburton off the bench. Cool. That seems okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
At the three, you're now looking at probably Harrison Barnes starting, even though he's better at the four these days, and then Jabari Parker.
Yeah.
Right, and you could ask the Bulls how the Jabari Parker at the three experiment went. It did not end well. So, like, I don't think they have a good answer unless it's similar to the Timberwolves. It's just play three guards and say go to hell to small forwards. Because, you know, they have a number of bigs. They have, you know, if you want to include Barnes and Parker at the four possibly, they still have Marvin Bagley. They have Rashawn Holmes. They have Bielitsa. And then they sign Hassan Whiteside, which, why?
It's the Kings. Do we really need to go into the whys? Because it's... I guess they looked at his stat line and went, production. And look, I don't necessarily disagree with some parts of their logic in regards to Hassan Whiteside. I don't think he's unplayable. No. I think he is a tremendous talent. It's not about that. It's a matter of roster symmetry. It's a matter of roster fit. They don't have it. I agree with you. Look, they should fire Luke Walton right now, bring in a new coach who is willing to play quick, and he should just say, you know what, screw it. De'Aaron Fox, Tyrese Haliburton in the backcourt, Buddy Hield at the three, Barnes at the four, Bagley at the five, go get it.
Mm-hmm.
Go get it. And then you have Rashawn Holmes and Nemanja Bjelica coming off the bench in the big positions, just holding down the fort. Go for it.
Yeah. Like, Hassan Whiteside on a one-year min deal is a good value signing.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was on his best behavior last year in Portland. I thought especially, you know, how he handled himself in the bubble where, like, he had a huge role all year. And then Nurkic comes back, he moves to the bench, his role decreases, and, you know, you didn't hear anything about his frustration, which could suggest that he's maturing, or it could just suggest on a winning team he's willing to make a sacrifice, particularly with a leader like Damian Lillard in the locker room. On a bad Kings team where, you know, I think it's safe to say they are not favored to make the playoffs, if he starts losing minutes to Rashawn Holmes or Marvin Bagley,
right,
how does he handle that? I'm concerned about, especially given the stuff with Heels, where, you know, he got pissed that he got benched and they wasn't returning Luke Walton's phone calls. Like, I feel like the combination of Heels and Whiteside in particular, you were just asking for your locker room to explode at one point.
Consider this for a moment. This is a guy who averaged 15.5 points, 13.5 rebounds, and a league leading. He led the damn league in blocks with 2.9 a game. Here you go. Minimum contract.
Yeah.
Has that ever been done before? Have we ever seen a guy with that stat line who, with a PER of 25 and a true shooting percentage of over 64, coming in and getting the minimum after playing 2,000 minutes in a season? I don't think so. And this is just all about, you know, the concerns about him in terms of personality,
mm-hmm.
you know, how he fits a locker room. So, yeah, when you can get a guy for the minimum who is of that, you know, talent level, yes, you have to, you at least have to say, that is tremendous value. We got to go for it, or at least we have to consider it. But you also have to remember, there's a reason we can get that guy.
Right. Right. You have to ask yourself, why can we get this guy at the minimum? Because
right.
You're right. On the surface, that seems like this guy should be making, you know, when Tristan Thompson and Mason Plumlee are getting $8 to $9 million a year.
Right.
Why is someone like Hassan Whiteside not even getting like a biannual exception? That seems like, you know, especially considering a team like Boston and Toronto, when Gasol and Ibaka left, like, those teams badly needed centers.
Right.
Like, you would think they would be first ones out the door to go get this guy. And, you know, who's to say they didn't? Well, I mean, I guess I'll say it, because he would definitely sign with one of those teams if they even offered him a min. You know, there's no reason to take a Sacramento min over one of those two. So, yeah, I get it from a talent perspective, but I am just very worried about things going extremely south for this Kings team. Like, if they don't get off to a hot start, or if, you know, if Hield gets benched again, or if they aren't running and De'Aaron Fox gets frustrated, look out, man. This Kings team could really, really implode.
Yeah, I am not a believer, and, you know, I'm hard on the Kings because I actually think there is an avenue wherein they could be good. And I think when they have a point guard like De'Aaron Fox, who is so quick, who is so controlled in the open court, who is so downhill, you know, he plays to the strengths of what you need an NBA point guard to be in this day and age. Like, he can put so much pressure on defenders, even big defenders, by going to the rim, attacking the basket, getting to the free throw line, just generating a ton of pressure, and then having just shooters around him to you know, kick outs. And, like, offensively, there's a point guard in there who is just optimized for today's NBA, and he's a good defender. So, like, if you go wrong with him, that is not hit on him. You know what I mean? Like, that's mm-hmm. on you. And he's entering his fourth year, right?
Yeah.
Okay, So that means so far, like, fair enough, when he's a rookie, like, you're still figuring out what is this dude. Now you have had him for 2 years where he's been really good, and this is your response with him going into year three, is saying, hey, let's not match Bogdan Bogdanović, who actually fits this playing style perfectly by him being a very good three-point shooter, by him being a very good guy to, like, run to the corner, to spot up, or a guy who can just kind of, you know, take over secondary ball handling capabilities if the offense breaks down a bit. Okay, you don't want to do that. Then what is it that you want to do? Just kind of start it over with Tyrese Haliburton? Like, what is your game plan here?
Right. My concern with the financial flexibility angle is really twofold. One, $18 million a year for Bogdanović, I don't think really hampers your flexibility moving forward. Like, if you really want to move off that deal at some point, I don't think you have to send out draft picks to do so. I think you probably get something in return for him. I know it's a 4-year deal. That's concerning. But, like, if you weren't willing to match that price point, you had to be ready to trade him at the deadline.
Yeah.
Like, you had to know that sort of an offer sheet was coming, probably from the Hawks. Like, this was all very predictable. And then, two, like, what about the Kings over the last 5 years suggest financial flexibility is a good thing for them? Like, okay, cool. They're going to go overpay Zach Randolph or Rajon Rondo again? Like, every time they have financial flexibility, they go out and burn it on overpaid free agents, much like we saw with Charlotte this year. Like, right. For some teams, financial flexibility is not a good thing unless you're so far in a so early in a rebuild where, you know, you're like OKC. It's like, all right, we'll use our cap space just to pick up a ton of picks, young players, whatever. But as you said, you know, you've got De'Aaron Fox now going into his fourth year. Buddy Hield's already going to be 28 in December. Like, now is the time where you should be ramping this thing up, not subtracting talent. And, right. You know, you just can't lose a player of Bogdanović's caliber without getting anything in return.
Which is why I think ultimately, like, let's say that they're going to be picking in the high, high lottery in 2021.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's the point where they should be willing to, and actually aggressive in, then trading De'Aaron Fox.
Mm.
Because why not just start all over again? And because he's getting impatient. Like, what is he doing? I know they only 22. He'll be 23 next month. But he can't wait around another, like, 3 or 4 years for guys to develop. Like, he'll be extremely frustrated. And then he'll, you know, reach his prime years. And then what if you whiff on a guy in the draft or you whiff on a guy in free agency? Then, you know, boom, there's his career. Just having been wasted away half of it at the least. So my thinking is, if they get a very high pick next year, move off of Fox, start all the way over, move off of Hield, like, don't keep anyone around over the age of, like, 22 outside of, like, veterans who are there for teaching purposes and locker room purposes, and then just, you know, hit the reset button. I because what they're doing now, like, having a foot in each camp, is just doesn't work. Like, we've seen it doesn't work, unless you're the Boston Celtics, in which case you kind of lucked a little bit into it because Jason Tatum was that good that soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think it's I know the guy just signed a 5-year extension, but I think that's more, okay, let's get our bag, and then we've seen how players can force their way out despite having multiple years. Like, I don't think if he goes to the Kings next year and says, trade me now, they have no reason to listen to him. He has no leverage. He's under contract for 5 more years. But if the Kings are looking at, okay, here's where we are, we have no pathway to getting above a top 8 seed, you know, they could be proactive in what they decide to do. But, yeah, a lot will determine on how the lottery shakes out next year.
And let the record reflect, Kings fans, I don't want you to lose De'Aaron Fox. You earned him. Like, you deserve him. That's not my point. I'm not trying to force him out of Sacramento, but I'm basically saying, you know, your management has really put themselves in a tough spot.
And it may come down to actually, if they want to rebuild again, they have to sacrifice probably their most attractive asset. Like the Bulls did it with Jimmy Butler. It's pretty common.
And you can get a lot for De'Aaron Fox right now.
Oh, boy. There are 25 teams that would be standing in line for this guy. Yes, yeah. You can. You can squeeze the ever-living hell out of a De'Aaron Fox trade package. Yes, you can.
Especially knowing he's under contract for five more years. I mean, exactly. That is the guy who, like, every team should be trying. You know, you're going to hear a lot of Bradley Beal trade rumors over the next few months. And, you know, who knows, looking down the line. But, like, yeah, if there's any rumblings that the Kings are willing to move on from Fox after this year, giddy up.
Man, look, I'll tell you as much. If the Bulls trade for him, I'll actually revert back to my fanhood.
Oh, I really would. Wow.
That's like the one scenario, because that's how much I love De'Aaron Fox.
Yeah.
It almost pains me at times to watch Kings games, but I do it because he's there. I think so highly of this kid. Like, he's smart. His play on the court is so efficient. Yeah, okay, he's got some shooting issues that'll need to be ironed out. But outside of that, he's just so damn quick. And he played in a system here last year that was not optimized for his capabilities. Could you imagine if he had not had Luke Walton roaming the sidelines? I mean, we could have been looking at a year where he'd averaged 25 points, man.
Yeah, I know. We saw it. Like you said earlier, there is a blueprint for the Kings to be good and fun and successful. And yes, that blueprint was the 2018-19 season. And then they fired Dave Yeager, hired Luke Walton. He slowed down the team despite having one of the fastest, most athletic point guards in the NBA. And here we are.
Yep. I'm depressed. Let's move on.
Oh, good. Well, since you were talking about teams that depress you, let's move to the San Antonio Spurs.
Well, I mean, that's unfair. You're just trying to get me into trouble with Jesse. That's fair. That's not fair.
All right. Well, let's start on the positive note. They once again pulled the Spurs and got, honestly, two players who fell to them that shouldn't have fallen to them. Devin Vassell at 11, Trey Jones, I believe, was 41.
41, yes.
Both of whom are perfect fits for that Spurs system. And the do have a really intriguing young backcourt with DeJounte Murray, Derek White, Lonnie Walker. White is up for an extension, or he's eligible for an extension this year. If you're the Spurs, would you extend him, or like what price point would you extend him at?
That's a good question. I have not dug deep into like Derek White's contractual value yet. I also think it's worth noting we keep labeling him as one of the young guys. He's 26.
He'll be 20. That's fair. That's fair.
He'll be 27 next summer. But the Spurs do have a lot of flexibility here, and they also have some leverage, because let's say a Derek White doesn't really take that huge step forward maybe this year that we saw he did in the bubble. Maybe that was just a bubble fluke. I hope not, and I don't necessarily think it is. But if it is, you know, you do have Trey Jones and Devin Vassell that can come in and take over those minutes. Trey Jones is good. He is a very, very good point guard. You know, when he came into Duke, he couldn't shoot as well. Like, he was very inconsistent. He became one of the best defensive-oriented point guards in the NCAA. He was able to get to the basket. He got better as a shooter. There's a lot to like with Trey Jones. I would be very, very surprised if he doesn't have, you know, one of those 10 years NBA career. Like, his ceiling might not be incredible, but I think his floor is fairly high. And for the Spurs, they love those kind of guys, especially in the second round. So great pickup for them. And I think that kind of makes it easier for them if, you know, Derek White hits the market and some team out there like Sacramento, who has financial flexibility, goes out to, you know, offer him like a huge offer sheet. They can look themselves in their eyes and go, okay, fair enough. We're not gonna match that, because that is just perverse, and we have players at our disposal who can fill those minutes. One guy we didn't even bring up, Lonnie Walker. Walker is a legit guy who can come into that rotation as well. They have a lot of depth at the 1-2, right? It's when you move above that, it becomes a little bit worrisome.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think for the a White extension, I wouldn't go nuts. I don't think I'd go
right.
Probably right around where DeJounte was. I think he was 464, if memory serves correctly.
So, yeah, something along those lines, like a little over 16, right?
Yeah. Especially if a guy like Fred VanVleet is only getting 21, not even 21 million per year. Like, you know, I think unfortunately for a lot of these guys, that's what happened this offseason in free agency is going to affect their market value. And a lot of these guys might decide to bet on themselves, you know, hoping that by 2021, 22, like, you know, God willing, we'll have a COVID vaccine and like we'll be able to have full stadiums again. And, you know, like maybe the NBA's finances will go back to normal. So Do you want to take an extension with this hanging over you for the entire 2020-21 season, knowing that, you know, Fauci came out and said, like, the NBA should not have full attendance at any point this year. So,
right,
you know, that is going to decrease hopes of a miracle revenue stream it's just not coming. But, you know, starting next year, it might. So I don't necessarily expect the Spurs to sign him to an extension unless it is just such a team-friendly. You know, they have no reason to, like, negotiate with him. They could just basically say, like, we're going to do a very team-friendly offer. If you don't take it, cool. We'll revisit it next offseason. You know, we'll see how this season shakes out. But, you know, I think it's not especially likely that he signs one.
Is 4 years, $50 million an insult?
I mean,
I understand it's on the low end. I understand that. But is it a fair enough opening offer, or is it one of those offers where Derek White and his camp goes, oh, F off?
It probably is too low for his camp to say yes, but...
No, just opening offer. I'm not expecting him to say yes, but if I open, like, if I'm the Spurs and I go in and I say 4 years, $50 million, it's $12.5 million a year. You know, that's the opening offer.
Right.
Is that so drastic, you know, a number that his camp just shuts down negotiations?
I mean, I hope not. I hope no agent works like that where, you know, you aren't even willing to like give a counter proposal. I think that is probably significantly lower than what he would ultimately want. But, so, you know, I just think, especially seeing what DeJounte got, I don't think he has a ton of leverage here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, knowing that Walker and Trey Jones are in the wings as well, considering his age, you know, I think it's going to be tough for him to negotiate much more than that. But I think he's a piece that the Spurs should want to keep around because, as you mentioned, in the bubble, he was fantastic. He had that playoff series against Denver where he, like, single-handedly won them two of the three of those games. You know,
the year before the bubble, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So the talent is there. You know, this goes back to your refrain, your frequent refrain of, like, this guy's a good three-point shooter. Why is he only taking three attempts per game? Like, we saw in the bubble, he started bombing away from deep, and all of a sudden it was like, oh, my God, this Spurs team's really fun.
I have the numbers right here for the bubble, actually. 8 three-pointers a game.
Yeah.
Hit 3.1, shot it at 39.3%. As a result, you know, he was averaging 19 points a game. And in less than 30 minutes, he was on fire. So if that's the version we're getting, or the Spurs are getting... Of course, you know, 450 is ridiculous, but I just, when I look over his career numbers and I look at his age, and I also look at the fact that he's not superbly athletic, which does limit his potential moving forward, I do think it's fair to say, and I also generally think because of his age, he is closer to his ceiling now, or to the player that he'll become full-time. That's why I'm kind of scared of, like, going into the whole, you know, 18, 19, 20 million a year kind of discussion.
Sure. No, that makes total sense. I think the other big storyline with the Spurs, of course, is, you know, they're kind of, like you were saying with the Kings, they're kind of towing the line between rebuild and compete now. They have a bunch of veterans on expiring deals. DeRozan, Aldridge, Rudy Gay, Patty Mills. We've discussed this plenty of times before, so I don't think we need to rehash whether they should blow it up and, you know, build toward the young guys, because that's clearly the path they are headed at some point.
Right.
I would just say, you know, we'll see what happens, how this start of the season gets off, and like whether that affects teams at the trade deadline. But, you know, if you're looking for teams that are able to upgrade, you know, the Spurs have a ton of guys on expiring contracts who could contribute to possible contenders. So if, like, I think there's real room for the Spurs this season to, you know, see where these first few months go. And if they go gangbusters and are like the top four seed, then they maybe don't blow it up. But if they're, mm-hmm. you know, hanging on the fringes of the playoff race, their playoff streak already snapped last year, maybe they just sell off those veterans to the highest bidder at the deadline. And then, you know, you get a head start on rebuilding around this next generation of young guys that you have.
What does stand out to me, though, when I look at the Spurs, it's they don't have that one guy. Mm. They are so far, actually, from having that one guy, that, mm-hmm. that major piece. So, like, how, if they're going to stay competitive, which I pour them for, let's just, I mean, you and I have talked about this before. How are they going to get that piece?
It's a fair question. Because I don't think, you know, I don't think the Miami Heat are trading Tyler Hero for LaMarcus Aldridge, or like the Boston right. Celtics are not trading Jaylen Brown for LaMarcus Aldridge or DeMar DeRozan, anything like that. Like, none of those guys, you can get value, especially on an expiring contract, you can get value for these guys, but it won't be, you know, a top five pick in next year's draft. Right. So, I think the answer, like it was toward the end of the Tim Duncan era, is draft well and hit on, you know, if you're a late lottery team or if you get another pick from another team and you luck into a higher lottery pick, but you got to find your next Kawhi. And it's a lot harder than it sounds, but I think that's their best path.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds right. It's, I like the fact that they did this somewhat organically, like instead of blowing it up years ago, even though I think they would have been better off. I do think it's going to be paid back positively that they kind of let their guys expire in a way where they show them the respect. They show the old guys mm-hmm. the respect of having them on the roster, having them, you know, be in the rotation. Hopefully that's something that gives them a brand outside of the on-court product that mm-hmm. helps them attract free agents, you know, down the line. But even then, I just struggle seeing, like, if they could ever get, like, a superstar in free agency. Like, who would actively go to San Antonio? And I say that as someone who has said repeatedly over the years, I think more free agents, star free agents, should actually look in the path of San Antonio. But mm-hmm. they just haven't. So what, you know, is it even realistic playing the free agent market? I think it's a fair discussion to have.
Yeah, I don't think it is. I think a trade or the draft are much more realistic options for them than free agency.
No.
All right, let's go to the Phoenix Suns now, Mort. We've talked a lot about them, or their offseason moves in last episode. You know, we said they were one of the bigger winners of free agency because of, you know, Chris Paul trade, Jay Crowder, and then the Langston Galloway, Etuan Moore, bringing those guys in on cheap deals. We have to focus on CP3 here. He is the mm-hmm. number one story for the Phoenix Suns this year. Do you think he can do to Phoenix what he did to OKC last year? Just, you know, provide them with that steady ball handler who just, like, the rising tide that lifts all boats.
Can he? Yeah. Will he? I don't know. Because we talked about this before. Basically, it is so difficult to project how a guy in his age group is going to perform over a full mm-hmm. year. He'll be 36 next year. So you're entering that age where the drop-off can theoretically happen. Do I think it will? No. I actually don't. I'm pretty confident it won't. But, you know, you just can't take that many chances with a guy that age. So, I don't know. I think he's so brilliant that even if his athleticism and like his speed was just starting to go a little bit, I think he can make up for so much of it just by playing smart, just by using his brain, just by, you know, sharing his vision with people. So it does raise the floor regardless. Absolutely. Will he be an all-star and catching lobs in oh no, the all-star game won't be played. I don't know. I don't know if he'll be on that level. I can see that the possibility exists, though.
Yeah, I mean, the tricky thing with Paul is that prior to last season, he played 70 games last season in a shortened season. Prior to that, in each of the past 3 years, he missed at least 21 games.
Right.
And as you mentioned, he is not getting any younger. He is 35, turning 36 in May. So I feel like that at least begs the question, you know, what is the backup plan if he gets hurt for some, you know, extended period of time, or even just in the minutes that he's not playing? Who Booker. Is the... Yeah, you think it's just point Booker?
Yeah. Like, I already knew where you were going, so apologies.
But yeah.
Booker, of course. Booker.
Yeah.
Like, look, he's been the primary playmaker for so long anyway. It's fine. And, you know, he's... If he has a few months under CP3 before CP3, you know, in this example goes down, yeah, I would feel confident in that.
And they do, I believe they have campaign coming back. I think he had a team option on his contract. Yeah. So, you know, not that campaign is going to replace what CP3 brought to the table, but it very limited 8-game sample size. He played well for them last year. You know,
he made Gar Forman proud.
Yeah, he sure did. But almost 11 points, you know, shot 48.5 overall, 51.7 from three, 4 rebounds, 3 assists. Like, you know, not the worst backup plan in the world. I mean, they did trade Ricky Rubio in the CP3 deal. They also traded Ty Jerome in the CP3 deal. So
they also just moved Eli Okobo, right?
Oh, did they?
I think they did.
It is so hard to keep track of every single move that happened this offseason.
I'm fairly sure they traded Eli Okobo because he was a guy that I've been wanting to for years to get a larger role.
But I
think it was Detroit, but I'm not sure right now because, like you said.
I'm glad we're not doing OKC today because I still can't name every single player on the OKC roster. I have no idea.
Well, it actually says Suns on his Wikipedia page, but that... No, Brooklyn Nets. There we go.
Oh.
Brooklyn Nets. Yeah.
All right. There
it wasn't Detroit. That's right. It was the Nets. I think just going to move it to Booker and let him figure things out. Like, he's reaching that point anyway, I think.
Yeah.
He's 24 now. He's played, let me just go check, almost 11,500 career minutes. You know, he's scored over 7,500 points for his career despite being just 24, which is insane. I think it's his time now. I think he's about to become a major topic on NBA Twitter and in the NBA, you know, stratosphere because he's going to elevate his game. Like, he may not replicate his raw numbers, but I think we're going to see a guy who just plays much, much smarter, much more efficiently. Just a guy who's gotten better at basketball, to be quite frank.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to hopefully go from good stats, bad team, to slightly worse stats, but better team.
Yeah.
You know, the question of, are you a stat padding superstar? Like, you know, do you actually meaningfully contribute to winning? This is his best chance yet to answer that question, and I think we saw in the bubble when they went 8-0, the answer is yes, because those games had stakes. I mean, those were probably the highest stakes game he's played in his career, and he aced that test. And I think the other big question with the Suns is then what to expect out of DeAndre Ayton, who only played 38 games last year, But in the games he did play, you know, 18 points, 11.5 rebounds, shot almost 55% overall, and much improved defensively compared to his rookie season.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think with CP3, again, like there could be a natural chemistry between, I definitely expect CP3 and Booker to play well together, but I actually think CP3 is going to help Ayton a lot too, right?
Yes, by even like just being vocal about him, vocal in regards to telling him, get your ass near the basket. I think that would be a smart one. Look, so almost 29% of Aiden's offense came from 3 feet and out to 16, which, like, why? That just doesn't make sense. This is a guy who shot over 72% within 3 feet. Like, go up. Go up hard. Like, this is a guy who barely shot free throws. You're 7'1", you're muscular, you're chiseled, you should be getting 7 to 8 free throws a game. So I think CP will let him know that. I think he'll let him look, you did you just take like a 7-foot jump shot? Are you kidding me? And he'll chew him out. And then next time down the court, he'll be like, you know what? I don't want to get yelled at again. Oh, I have that 7-foot jump shot right now, but you know what? I'm actually going to put the ball on the floor and get inside and see if I can jam it on somebody. There you go. It worked. Hey, because I'm a tall human being who's greatly athletic, I can actually do this. Wow, interesting. Right. Who knew?
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, like, Lord knows CP3, during the Lob City Clippers days with DeAndre Jordan, he has experience, you know, maximizing a much more limited big man. I think it's, I mean, I can't say this for sure, but just off the top of my head, between, you know, Adams last year, Clint Capella before that, DeAndre Jordan before that, like, Ayton strikes me as the most talented big he's played with ever, possibly.
Just going back.
I guess he had Tyson Chandler earlier in his career, right?
He did with
New Orleans. I mean, yeah.
You know, so, but Tyson, while good, was never, he was never that skilled, especially offensively. Right. Like, defensively, he had great timing, great instincts, but, you know, he came into the league billed as a guy who could do, you know, everything. Remember, I followed the Bulls very, very closely back then. So, and when he came in, he was way more stiff than people thought he'd be. You know, people were putting him up as the new Kevin Garnett, a guy who could, and again, remember, this is 2001, he's 7'1", and he can play the small forward position. You know, that was what people back then tried to make the small forward position. Ayton is, yeah, I would argue you're right. I mean, he's probably the most skilled big man that Paul has ever played with, unless I'm totally forgetting someone here.
Yeah, this was purely off the top of my head, and I strictly mean offensively, because yes, he is Ayton is not Tyson Chandler, what prime Tyson Chandler was defensively. But it feels like,
I think you're right there. I mean, the best big man probably might be David West, but that's not
right, or Blake Griffin. But like, these are power forwards more than, like, just in terms of pure center. I feel like Ayton is probably the most skilled offensively. So it'd be really, I'm interested to see how those three pieces fit in particular. And then also, luckily, like, you know, losing Kelly Oubre is going to hurt, but bringing in Jay Crowder, as we discussed last episode, that's a great replacement for him. You re-signed Dario Saric to a reasonable deal. You know, you have Cam Johnson off the bench as well. Like, this Suns team is going to be, you know, it's the West, so I don't want to say they're a guaranteed playoff team, but if nothing else, they're going to be fun as hell. Like, I'm excited to watch the Phoenix Suns for the first time, and I don't even know how long.
No, I agree. I think they'll be good.
Then let's wrap up more with another team that is going to be fun as hell to watch. The NBA draft Twitter favorite, Memphis Grizzlies, who didn't really do much this offseason because they didn't have to do much. They didn't have a ton of cap space. So, you know, they got Desmond Bane in the draft. They got the 30th pick, took him. Other than that, I mean, the big addition to this team they made at the trade deadline was, you know, they were supposed to have a ton of cap space, and then they didn't, because they traded for Justice Winslow, and, you know, they gave up Iguodala and a couple, Jay Crowder, a couple pieces. So, How do you see Winslow fitting, you know, God, knock on wood, assuming he's healthy, right, how do you see him fitting with the Grizzlies core, specifically Morant and Jaren Jackson Jr.?
No, I think in an optimized world where he is healthy and productive, I think his ball handling and his passing makes him like this seamless fit. What he will need to do is hit the three at a consistent rate to really keep that defense honest. But he's one of those guys. He's never going to be someone who comes in and, like, you know, I'm going to go for 18 tonight. Like, no, mm-hmm. he just makes the plays. And I think if you get him under those circumstances and you kind of let Ja Morant, Jaren Jackson Jr., and Jonas Valanciunas take care of the offense, and I realize I didn't mention Dylan Brooks there. This is slightly intentional because I think he had just too many Kobe shots last season where mm-hmm. I would want him to scale back on that a little bit before I feel comfortable circling him in as part of the offensive core. But no, I mean, just having him out there as a passer, as a facilitator, as a strong defender too, mind you, that's crucial. He could be one of those, you know, Swiss Army knife kind of guys who opens up the entire game for everyone else. I don't want to say necessarily a younger Andre Iguodala, because that is not putting enough respect into what Iggy used to be. Mm-hmm. But someone who resembles that type of player.
Yeah, that a similar archetype, at least. Correct. Where it's he would be miscast as a number one scorer, as Iguodala was in Philly post-Iverson.
Right.
But as we saw with the Warriors, when he goes there, okay, we don't need him to be the number one scorer anymore. We can just have him be this, like, do-it-all versatile swingman.
Right.
Oh, suddenly he's like...
We don't even need you to score at all anymore.
Right. Just guard the LeBron James in the finals. That's all we need. And, like, okay, suddenly he's the finals MVP. Like, it's just a matter of finding the role that fits him the best. And I agree with you. In Memphis, next to a Ja Morant and Jaren Jackson Jr., he's not. They don't need him to score 20 points a game, even 15 points a game. It's, you know, you can be a secondary playmaker and kind of just do everything. Like, we're cool with you getting 12 points, 7 rebounds, 5 assists. Like, that's the perfect Justice Winslow line next year, I think.
I mean, that would be great. And then, because I've been harping on this for years, I know it doesn't make a lot of sense, but I just want it. I want to see it. I want to see Jonas Valanciunas get 32 minutes a game.
I feel like we're going to say that literally every season going into the season, and it's never going to happen. And you're just it's going to be your running bit forever.
It might be, but I'm willing to die on this hill. he is a good player. I mean, this is a guy who averaged 15 and 11 in 26 minutes last season.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's not a liability when it comes to the free throw line or the 3-point shot, which he's begun hitting. Like, he's even improved his passing. You know, defensively, sure, he's not a star, but he's sound, at least close to the rim. I want to give him more touches. There's another selfish component to this, because I don't want Ja Morant to burn out. I am a big mm-hmm. Ja Morant fan. I don't want him to be the type of guy who feels that he has to come out and get you 25 a night. I don't think that would be a good bet for his career. I think for him, even though he's certainly capable of it, I think for him, he should have this slow and steady rise to the top where he is at his best when he goes into like the 6 to 7 year mark. Because there are so many players, when you look at it, like, they come out like gangbusters in the early parts of their careers, and then they just get stuck in the scoring pattern with not a lot of influence, and they sort of just hang around that. I mm-hmm. want the offense to flow, you know, through other players, so he doesn't have to feel that he should shoulder that responsibility at that age.
Yeah, that's fair. So that begs the question, because, you know, Ja Morant's sidekick in this new look grit and grind era is Jaren Jackson Jr., who's heading into a very pivotal third year. After this season, he will be eligible for an extension.
Right.
Took a big leap, especially as a 3-point shooter this past season. Went from know, 2.4 attempts per game, shooting 35.9% from three as a rookie, went up to 6.5 per game, shot 39.4% from three last season. So do you think that's the key to keep Ja from feeling that much pressure, feeling like, a you know, what Donovan Mitchell had in Utah his first couple of years, where it's like, okay, all right, Jaren Jackson's just got to bomb 8, 9, 10 threes a game?
Yeah, that's part of it. I mean, along with Valanciunas and Dylan Brooks in an optimized version, yes, absolutely. Look, so Jackson hit more threes than he took in the first year.
I mean, yeah.
That's where we are. That's significant growth. But it's not just a matter of the percentages and the mix. It's how he made them. You know, when we watch Memphis, he takes the most strange-ass three-point shots you've ever seen from a big man. I think that's fair to say, right?
It's up there. I mean, yeah. I do remember Andrew Bynum attempting three-point shots. So I don't want to say the most.
But like he, not many with him. Yeah, no, he takes seven a game. But I'm saying, you know, a guy who he can come off screens and like mm-hmm. be several feet behind the line, and he'll just square up, and he'll come down the court like he'll be the trailer. He'll be a few feet behind the line. He'll just grab it and shoot in one motion. And you know what? It's not necessarily a bad shot because it goes in.
Yeah. He shoots like a guard. He's a big man, or like a guard in a 6'11 body almost.
Yes. I think that is very, very fair, especially as a jump shooter. The release is a little bit funky, but it's quick. He gets it off at a good time. He hits his free throws. You know, what you want to see now for him is now you need to add the big man component. Like, now you need to become a better rebounder. Now you mm-hmm. need to do those things that makes you a more attractive big man in that sense, because you're not going to be able to move down to the three. I mean, while you move around like a guard offensively shooting the three, that's fine, but I don't trust your lateral movement when it comes to, like, sliding out and guarding threes full-time at least. Yeah, you know, he can pick up the occasional one, but he's a big in some capacity, whether that's a center, whether that's like a new age four, I don't care. He's not a guard. He's not a wing. He's more than that. So that means there are some responsibilities in coming in and rebounding, getting better as a playmaker so you can pass out of the post or pass out mm-hmm. of like the mid-range area when he's in there. But you know what? That's one of those things that I kind of feel comfortable with will come. Like, I'm not sitting here sweating it, if you catch my drift. Like, it's
yeah.
his work ethic, his dedication to the game, it's so unique that I'm like, yeah, he'll get it. I'm not worried.
I mean, he is still outrageously young for a guy who's been in the NBA for 2 years. He just turned 25 in mid-September.
21.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, 21. So, like, I mean, what, Obi Toppin is older than him already, right?
Oh, yes, yes.
But, yeah, by almost, over a year. Yeah, like a year and a half almost. So,
yeah.
You know, Jaren Jackson is by no means a finished product. The fact he's come along this far offensively, I think, is a really good sign for the Grizzlies. I'm totally with you. You know, 4.6 rebounds per game as his career average, and also what he had last season. Not especially great from what you would want from a big man, but I mean, he does have Valanciunas vacuuming up boards. Right. Also,
correct.
Jay Crowder averaged 6.2 a game while
Brandon
he was
Clark, you know, is there.
Yeah, so he has some competition, but yeah, like, you know, you'd at least like to see that get up to the 6-7 ish range, even if he's not averaging a double double. But you know, it's got to be above five. Because then you're starting to get some Miles Turner vibes. But, like, at least on the bright side, the offense is there. Unlike Miles Turner, where it's just like, this is what... Jaren Jackson Jr. is what we want offensively out of Miles Turner, I feel like.
Yeah. I think that's a very, very fair thing to say. Yeah.
But, I mean, defensively, you would like to see Jaren Jackson Jr. turn into what Miles Turner is. He's not a great rebounder, but great shot blocker. I mean, just fantastic defensive instincts all around.
And I think he's got that potential. We saw that at college. We see, you know, currently, I think for his age, he's a fine defender. I think he's mm-hmm. on the pathway to it. But like you said, he just turned 21. So he's still learning the NBA game.
Yeah.
But I'm not worried about it. I'm really not. I think this is just going to come in time. And I think what the Grizzlies are doing, just basically loading up with the proper players around their established young core, is pretty smart, because they're trying to optimize those guys to the best of their ability. That's clever.
Yeah, I am very excited to see this Memphis team. I'm staking my claim right now as they are my West Coast or my Western Conference team, because Jaren, Ja, Brandon Clark, now you add Desmond Bane to the mix. Like,
yeah,
this could just be such a fun team. We need to do league pass rankings too. It's another episode, but they will be high in my league pass rankings if we have time to do them this year.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's a good place for us to wrap up, Mort. So thank you all for listening. Hope you're staying safe out there. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And we also recorded today live on the Locker Room app. So download Locker Room if you have an iOS device. You can come hang out live, ask some questions, even speak with us during an episode. So check that out, Locker Room app. They are working on an Android version as well for those Android users out there. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, Brian. Don't die, man.